Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we actually have quite a few different things that I want to get through, going through the notes, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. Now, we don't have Paul with us, so I have to lament on the fact that, you know, Paul's busy, and I know he's got a lot of stuff that he has to take care of regarding, you know, I mean, we all do, usually springtime, it's time for cleaning, getting, you know, gardens ready. There's, you know, usually a lot of work this time of year. And so Paul, on top of whatever the normal seasonal stuff is, he's got a national convention for the Constitution Party he's going to, and he's going to be presenting a significant platform change. And when I say a significant platform change, I mean, this is huge. It's a paradigm shift. It's moving away from platitudes. It's moving away from the unnecessary positions and simplifying the party platform to strictly demanding full compliance to the Constitution, that the federal government, for the federal, so let me back up. There should be two platforms in every state. There should be a federal platform, and then there should be a state platform. And that state platform should be based upon those enumerated powers that have been given to your state government, as well as your county governments. Now, here's the problem, that your county governments have not created their own constitutions. Or I should say, we the people have failed to institute our county governments. So until we actually create those constitutions, we've got a bunch of administrators doing what they're told by bureaucrats and lobbyists and so forth. And so we need to engage. We need to step in. I've been working with teams, and the question is, why am I not working with you? I'm not here to, you know, line my pockets with gold. I am not a conservative entertainer, and I don't think I'm entertaining. I mean, I like humor, and I think lots of things are funny, or those things that I think are funny. That doesn't mean that you would. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I'm here to entertain you with humor or my humor. But I do share it. And if you get a giggle, if you find, you know, yourself amused, well, that's fine. That's great. I love it. So what we're here to do is we're here to give you the actual words, the framers speaking from the dust on what these things really mean. Now, they may have said, you know, they may have written that Constitution, but they argued over that, what those things really meant. And this is why it is so important that we live by those definitions that were provided and created in the process of establishing these compacts, these contracts that are still alive today. Those definitions actually transcend the time frame of their existence. I mean, they span and maintain the same definitions from then to today. So understanding these things is really important. Because when we really start looking at what all of these lines mean, I say this a lot, and I know that, you know, people get what I mean in context to their understanding, but this goes beyond the average understanding when I say only the Lord knew what we would be facing, and he gave us everything we need in this Constitution to deal with our government. He knew what we would need. He knew what we would have to do, and he gave it to us. Every time I turn around, I find that right there in the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, specifically the 14th Amendment, is a huge contribution from him. And I hear people all the time saying disparaging comments. I mean, old-time patriots, some of the, you know, the diehards, the guys that have been around a long time, they have been regurgitating the progressive narrative regarding the 14th Amendment. Same thing with the 13th Amendment, the original 13th Amendment, but I digress. So I have a few different topics and so forth, and actually that we've been addressing and kind of talking about. And so what I want to do is I kind of want to go through these topics that, you know, are covered in Madison's notes, because that's what our focus is. I want to kind of wrap this up so I can get this document posted on the website. What I'm doing is I go through this, I'm editing this so that it's easier for you to navigate, and we highlight the very specific words with different kinds of colors of highlights and so forth. And yellow is kind of like the early stuff that we've covered, either insightful things or things regarding the electors. Blue is things regarding property and land. And I think I even have gray. And let me try to find what the gray topic is. I forget. It's going to be in here. And of course, it's going to be in here. But let me get to... I think this is gray right here. Yeah, I'm pretty sure this is. And the part that I'm looking for is the property and the compromise of slavery in the Constitution. And so there's this point, and actually, interestingly enough, I have this all highlighted, but it got unhighlighted, and I'm wondering how that happened. But anyway, the part regarding slavery, this is a lot of stuff that just got lost. So the stuff regarding the slavery and or the property, the context of that, is going to be highlighted with red or that type of stuff. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to make this a very informative document, so that as you're reading along, you know, as I read, the stuff that's highlighted is the stuff I read and the stuff that Paul's read. And so that way you can kind of go to the document and you can read along with us. I mean, sometimes it helps to actually read along. I mean, I would rather you actually pull it up and read along for one very specific reason. So, you know, I'm not just making this up. I want you to actually become a witness to your world that this is what these words actually say, because I don't have to be the one saying it anymore. You can say these things. Now, as we kind of look at the different topics, so let me just kind of give you how very specific words were used. Like we talked about electors, right? So when I type the word electors in the search for the whole document, electors comes up 145 times. When I type the word property, and how many times that comes up, because I should have probably done this, property comes up, let me see here, if I spelt it right, property comes up 124 times. So we've kind of highlighted all of those times. And I've even looked up land. So I believe land itself, you know, and you have to put a space in front of the L and the and then after the D so that it's isolated that land is what you're pulling in. Then when you get to that, then you go, oh, okay, that's interesting. Now we see that there are this many times, and I think it's like 14 times, they talk about land. And there are some very specific things that are critical regarding land when we start talking about it. And so what we want to do is we want to shift gears, because there's plenty of things in the Constitution. Like I said, elector is listed a lot of times. And so the topic I want to just kind of start covering today, we'll cover it for a little while. I'm not going to go into it into the nth degree, but I do want to get into the instances of property when all of a sudden property really started taking place or I should say the context of property really started taking place regarding representation. I don't want to reread some of these things. So as we already know, it was June 11th. So we kind of covered, what was this, the Hamilton Plan or whatever. We covered many of these things regarding this, the word property. Oh, it's the commission. So we covered this probably a couple of weeks ago. But nevertheless, as we kind of go through and we've covered these things, I don't want to reread them again. And Mr. Gary thought the property, not the rule of representation. So as they kind of break things down and how they were defining these things, why is this so important? Because property rights were quintessential. As a matter of fact, they get into, you know, actually starting to discuss this whole concept of property and the whole point of government. And so the first instance that we're going to talk about is the form of government. And this is under Madison. So we have not brought this up yet, but this is kind of the new thing that the new topic, and then we'll get into property as well, because property is kind of included in this. And so Mr. Madison, and this is actually on June 26th in Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And so Mr. Madden basically says, in order to judge the form to be given to this institution, this federal government, it will be proper to take a view to the ends to be of the ends to be served by it. These were the first to protect the people against their rulers. Secondly, to protect the people against the transient impressions to which they themselves might be led. A people deliberating in temperate moment and with the experience of other nations before them on the plan of government, most likely to secure their happiness, would first be aware that those charged with public happiness must betray their trust. Excuse me. I want you to understand what he just said. This is probably one of the more profound things. When we start examining what Madison's talking about, he's talking, again, this is all in context to this form of government, this new form of government, and the context that how well he understood how government operates. And he says, I'm going to repeat this. In order to judge, and I'm going to not stumble as much in the second time here. In order to judge of the form to be given to this institution, the form of government being Republican. This is a Republican form of government. To be given to this institution, we call the federal government. And actually, all states, because of the Constitution, guarantees that each state be Republican in form, which means that your counties, before you create your states, must be Republican in form as well. It will be proper, going back to what Madison says, it will be proper to take a view of the ends to be served by it, those to be served by it. These were first to protect people against their rulers. Secondly, to protect the people against the transient impressions into which they themselves might be led. Now, let me talk about these transient impressions. All of a sudden, we have this plague. And what I would tell you and defer you to do is to go look at the Medical Freedom Petition, petition number 9, on our website. And oh, by the way, because we're kind of covering the presidential how a presidential president, a constitutional president, let me get this right, how a constitutional president could actually serve America and lead us back into a land of liberty. Now, when we look at what, you know, I've been doing on the petitions, I have not updated it, so I want to let you know that we now have petition 1 to 17. That doesn't mean we have all 17. There's a couple of petitions that aren't done yet. So I think it's 11 and 12 that aren't done. So I believe we have 15 petitions now. there's a lot of things that you need to understand in some of these petitions. So we'll probably go through that down the road. But getting through this content, because I want to place context to what we're doing. And we kind of took this aside in going through the constitutional president, because this was kind of on the heels of the State of the Union address and kind of kicking off this presidential, campaign for this coming November. And so I wanted to revisit how I framed the power that the president really has within the Constitution to actually do what, no president has done. No president has done since probably James Madison and back when the Constitution was revered and adhered to. So anyway, these transient things that Madison is talking about are those things that come up like in the 1800s, as we list this in the currently in the Medical Freedom, and this will also be listed in the challenge to the Department of Health and Human Services, because all of these powers, the Health and Human Services Department was created through this cascading of overreach by the federal government. This overreach was done because of transient things, or as he basically says here, that these are transient impressions. Oh, we've got this plague that is, killing people. The federal government has no enumerated power to be involved in healthcare and all of that. That is a state issue. But this federal government came along and said, we got this thing over here in the corner called the printing press, and we actually have this ability to print some cash and, throw money at a problem, and that's what we're going to do. And back in the late 1800s, when they started actually separating the actual coins in hand by giving you greenbacks or giving you a piece of paper that represented so many ounces of silver, so many ounces of gold. Well, okay, so that you've got all of this cash in hand. Well, they actually took federal dollars without having the constitutional authority to do this, and they spent it on trying to help save lives. Now, that's really nice and noble, but again, this is a transient impression where they had no authority to do this. And so the people go, oh, well, this is great. We're starving, so give us food. Well, this is great. We're cold. Give us a coat. We're lazy. Give us welfare. And all of these things are destructive. George Washington warned us to not allow the Constitution to be done without amending the Constitution, because it's by allowing these things to happen how good governments are destroyed. Even Washington understood this. So, moving on, Madison states this: a people deliberating in a temperate moment and with the experience of other nations before them on the plan of government most likely to secure their happiness would first be aware of those charged with the public happiness might betray their trust and do these things they have no authority to do. I just added that. An obvious precaution against this danger would be to divide the trust between different bodies of men who might watch and check each other. In this, they would be governed by the same prudence which has prevailed in organizing the subordinate departments of government, where all business liable to abuses is made to pass through separate hands, the one being a check on the other. The separate hands being your state government, being a completely different body, and your county government. Even though you vote for representation in all of these, it's to make sure that the proper hand is operating with the proper government. If it is a transient thing, the proper government that you need to deal with is your county government. All transient things are to be addressed there. Ah, but the ease of just going to the federal government and reaching into the till and just helping ourselves is so appealing. I mean, come on, let's cut to the chase. Give me the money. Counties don't have an abundance of money. They have tight budgets because we didn't give them the authority to just take everything and then give it back to us when we need it. See, nobody is going to ever empower a government to that degree. But that's exactly how the progressives, and that's how democracy really works, that we have the ability to do those things. And in our government, they don't. They have enumerated powers. There's no general powers granted to your state and to your general government. To be clear, those powers delegated are very clearly defined. It's a power of attorney. It's a specified, not a general, a specified power of attorney. Now, moving on, basically Madison continues saying, it would next occur to such people that they themselves were liable to temporary errors through what information as to their interest, and that men chosen for a short term, their public servants and employed, but a small portion of that in public affairs, might err from the same cause. This reflection would naturally suggest that the government be so constituted as that one of its branches might have an opportunity of acquiring a competent knowledge of public interest, another reflection equally becoming a people on the occasion, equally becoming to the people on occasion, would be that they themselves, as well as a numerous body of representatives, were liable to err also from fickleness and passion. A necessary fence against this danger would be to select a portion of enlightened citizens who limited number and firmness might seasonably interpose against impetuous counsels. In other words, these illogical or emotional reactions to the problem du jour, the problem of the day. Madison goes on and he says, it ought finally to occur to a people deliberating on a government for themselves that as different interests necessarily result from the liberty meant to be secured, the major interest might under sudden impulses be tempted to commit injustice on the minority. In all civilized countries, the people fall into different classes, having a real or supposed difference of interest. There will be creditors and debtors, farmers and merchants, and manufacturers. There will be particularly the distinction of rich and poor. It was true, as had been observed by Mr. Pinckney, we had not among us those hereditary distinctions of rank which were a great source of the contests in the ancient governments, as well as the modern states of Europe, nor those extremes of wealth or poverty which characterize the latter. We cannot, however, be regarded even at this time as one homogeneous mass in which everything that affects a part will affect the same manner in the whole. Now, I'm going to run out of time right here. So what we're going to do is we're just going to take a pause at this point right here. And as we go into this break, we will, you know, come right back to where I just left off. Because what Madison is hitting on is he's really hitting on, you know, the importance of these checks and balances. And just to be clear, you know, when you institute a government, you've instituted a power, an insatiable power that will want to take everything from you. And so we'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me go back to the beginning of the sentence because I realized I was not going to be able to finish this. So, because it's a long sentence. And place a little breather context. So starting off this last sentence, we cannot, however, be regarded, even at this time, as one homogeneous mass in which everything that affects a part will affect in the same manner the whole. Now, what he was basically saying, what I didn't get a chance to do, is if you look at starvation, you know, if there's a drought, if that drought is affecting one, nine times out of ten, the drought is much greater, or that problem. It's the same thing with, you know, a pandemic, or I should say an outbreak of the flu. It usually spreads, and the damage is equally spread. And so he basically kind of says that, hey, in framing a system, this is the next line, in framing a system which we wish to last for ages, we should not lose sight of the changes which ages will produce. An increase of population will of necessity increase the proportion of those who will labor under all the hardships of life and secretly sigh for a more equal distribution of its blessings. These may in time outnumber those who are placed above the feelings of indigence. Now, when we look at those who, and this goes to Tytler's cycle of democracy, in the common knowledge, and I believe Alexander Tytler, I believe he was Scottish, lived in Adam Smith and the Framers' time frame, and it was common knowledge. I think Tytler was the one that actually committed it to writing, that democracies always lead to destruction because of this cycle, and I believe the cycle was named after Tytler, Alexander Tytler, and that cycle is that when people create a government, you know, and it's a government of liberty, then there's lots of people that are just growing under the umbrella of blessings. All of a sudden, a few people decide to convince government so that they don't have to work so hard. The government helps them a little bit. But it's not to them. It's actually to people that really can't do anything for themselves. That's how it starts. Then, quickly, people start realizing, but by creating more and more pressure on government to provide relief, it gives them the opportunity to shift from working and becoming a maker and transitioning into becoming a taker. And so eventually, over time, the takers grow and grow to a point where they outnumber not necessarily the makers, but the maker's ability to sustain the takers. And then shall the end come. because then you see the system collapse because there's more people wanting to take than those capable of making. And that all of a sudden there's this complete collapse because now there's not enough. And what ends up happening is government ends up starting to just print money and starts inflating. And so when you see what's going on today, this is a direct result of the fact that the makers are not making a sufficient amount for the takers, as well as for government to spend their, the makers' money on things that they think are more important. More important, or to justify the, you know, the future taking or the future destruction of the nation. That's why this cycle. And I think there's these stages of the cycle, but moreover, that's what Madison is talking about here. And he talks about these hardships of life and secretly sigh for more equal distribution of its blessings. Then he goes on and says, these may in time outnumber those who are placed above the feelings of indigence. That's where we left off. According to the equal laws of suffrage, the power will slide into the hands of the former. No agrarian attempts have yet been made in this country, but symptoms of a leveling spirit, as we have understood, have sufficiently appeared in a certain quarters to give notice of the future danger. How is this danger to be guarded against on Republican principles? How is the danger in all cases of interested coalitions to oppress the minority to be guarded against? Among other means, by the establishment of a body in the government sufficiently respectable for its wisdom and virtue to aid on such emergencies, the preponderance of justice by throwing its weight into that scale, such being the objects of the second branch in the proposed government, he thought a considerable duration ought to be given to it. He did not conceive that the term of 9 years would threaten any real danger, but in pursuing his particular ideas on the subject, he should require that the long term allowed to the second branch should not commence till such a period of life as would render a perpetual disqualification to be reelected little inconvenient, rather. And when we talk about the second branch of government, they're really, I believe, at this point in time, they're still talking about the Senate. And so he observed that it was more than probable we are now digesting a plan which in its operation would decide forever the fate of Republican government. We ought not only to provide every guard to liberty that its preservation could require, but equally careful to supply the defects which our own experience has particularly pointed out. Now, here's the interesting thing. Madison is writing this document, and here Madison is talking about himself. So the way he, you know, talks is kind of like third person. And in some cases, and as a matter of fact, there was some stumbling there because he was poorly reflecting his mind's thoughts in a third-person way. Now, Mr. Sherman then pipes up and says this, Mr. Sherman from Connecticut, government is instituted for those who live under it. It ought, therefore, to be constituted as not to be dangerous to their liberties. The more permanency it has, the worse if it be a bad government. Frequent elections are necessary to preserve the good behavior of rulers. They also tend to give permanency to the government by preserving that good behavior because it ensures their reelection. In Connecticut, elections have been very frequent, yet great stability and uniformity, both as to persons and measures, have been experienced from its original establishment to the present time. A period of more than 130 years, he wished to have provision made for steadiness and wisdom in a system to be adopted, but he thought 6 or 4 years would be sufficient. He should be content with either. So in other words, he's okay with 6 or 4 years for the Senate, 2 years for the House. Now, let's think about that. If we change the House of Representatives to 1 year, it would make the House of Representatives really difficult for them to get away with voting for something and not having to defend it. Now, what happens if you've got a 2-year cycle, then they are able to get away with something in 1 year and then come up with a new exigency, a new, oh, we got this new problem, we got to do this now. And they basically obviate the stuff that they've done and campaign on the things that they need to do now and that they're willing to do them. But there is merit, folks, in making these guys perpetually seek re-election in the House of Representatives. It forces them to defend their actions of the year. If we allow them, the longer that they can play this game, like when you look at the Senate, how the Senate plays this game of, oh, well, these are the things we had to do so that we could get these things done, and now we've got to go do these things, and you need to reelect me so that we can get those done. And technically, all those things that they've been doing are things that they should never have been doing in the first place. When you understand that the Senate is supposed to be representing the suffrage of the states, that ain't happening, folks. What we're seeing is that the Senate is making appeals for a populist government or making appeals out to the people. They're not supposed to be doing that. Article 5 of the Constitution clearly dictates that the equal suffrage, no state shall lose its equal suffrage in the Senate without its consent. So in other words, if the state legislatures have not consented that their senators actually vote and support other things rather than what they want them to do, then that means that they've lost their suffrage without their consent. And they can hold them accountable. In other words, the senators that are ignoring the state legislatures can be removed by the state legislatures for violating the, because the 17th Amendment does not change their responsibility, does not address Article 5. And so if you start understanding this, this is one of the reasons why state legislatures, all they need to do, because Delaware had set the precedence in 2010, all your state legislature needs to do is rescind its ratification of the 17th Amendment and reject it and then basically call back all their senators who are not giving them equal suffrage on the charge of violating their oath of office. It's that simple. Now, there's a few things that they need to do, and we can have that conversation, but let me move on to Mr. Reed. And actually, what I have done and what I'm going to do in some of these subsequent readings, because I actually got to a point where I go, you know what? I need to provide you with who this person is that's, you know, where, what state, and are they an anti-federalist? I haven't been doing that. And so I kind of created a table of all of the delegates that were at the Constitutional Convention. And so this next person is Mr. Reed. And so I have to, you know, go through the long list of all of these guys that were there and find Mr. Reed. And so where is Mr. Reed? And if I look, he is right here in Delaware. So none of the anti-federalists, by the way, so one of the things I noted was Delaware, as a group of delegates, unanimously accepted and signed the Constitution. There were only a couple of other states that did that. The other two states that did that was the Pennsylvania delegation and the South Carolina delegation. As a matter of fact, over half of the Virginia delegation refused to sign the Constitution. John Blair, Madison, and Washington were the only ones that signed it. Now, Governor Randolph didn't sign it, but Governor Randolph was not truly an anti-federalist, and I say that because Governor Randolph proved himself when it came down to the ratification debates, where he was actually the proponent for it. He was out there supporting it and helping explain what each of those lines mean. In other words, he was a Federalist position. So he had to square himself with the rest of the delegates of why did he not sign it, but he's still supporting it. And so that became one of those lifetime, you know, gotchas. You know, you ever do something that, and you weren't really thinking, maybe you were being driven by principle or some feeling, and all of a sudden you said, I'm not going to sign this, I'm not going to do this, right? You choose to do something or not do something, and then that bites you in the butt later. Well, that was exactly what happened with Governor Morris. And so as he, or Randolph, I mean, he had to defend himself a lot during the ratification. He was even called out as a flip-flopper. Remember that presidential election with Bush and Kerry, flip-flop, and people had a little flip-flop that'd hold up. Anyway, as we go through this now, Mr. Reed, as I just said, Mr. Reed was a part of the Delaware delegation. And this is what he said. He wished it to be considered by the small states that it was their interest that we should become one people as much as possible, that state attachments should be extinguished as much as possible, that the Senate should be so constituted as to have the feelings of the citizens of the whole. Hamilton then goes and says he did not mean to entirely or enter particularly into the subject. He concurred with Mr. Madison in thinking we are now to decide forever the fate of Republican government, and that we did not give to that form due stability and wisdom, it would be disgraced and lost among ourselves, disgraced and lost to mankind forever. Hamilton acknowledged himself not to think favorably of Republican government, but addressed his remarks to those who did think favorably of it, in order to prevail on them to tone their government as high as possible. He professed himself to be as a zealous an advocate for liberty as any man whatever, and trusted he should be as willing a martyr to it, though he differed as to the form in which it was most eligible. He concurred also in the general observations of Mr. Madison on the subject, which might be supported by others if it were necessary. It was certainly true that nothing like an equality of property existed, that an inequality would exist as long as liberty existed, and that it would unavoidably result from that very liberty itself. Now, let me just repeat this because we're talking about property. Now, I'm going to go ahead and he started over for where he concurred in the general observations of Mr. Madison on the subject, which might be supported by others if it were necessary. It was certainly true that nothing like an equality of property existed, that an inequality would exist as long as liberty existed, and that it would unavoidably result from that liberty itself. Now, in other words, if you're going to have in a liberal society where, you know, people are free, and you're going to have this equality of property, then if you're going to have that, then you will also have to have an inequality of property. And then he goes on and says, this inequality of property constituted the great and fundamental distinction in society. When the tribunal power had leveled you can read this, and then he says, when this tribunal power had leveled the boundary between the patricians and the plebeians, what followed? The distinction between rich and poor was substituted. He meant not, however, to enlarge on the subject. He rose principally to remark that Mr. Sherman seemed not to recollect that one branch of the proposed government was so formed as to render it particularly the guardians of the poorer orders of civilization, or the citizens, nor to have adverted to the true causes of the stability which had been exemplified in the Constitution. Under the British system, as well as the federal, many of the great powers appertaining to government, particularly all those relating to foreign nations, were not in the hands of the government there. Their internal affairs also were extremely simple, owing to sundry causes, many of which were peculiar to that country. Of the late government had entirely given way to the people, and had in fact suspended many of its ordinary functions in order to prevent those turbulent scenes which had appeared elsewhere. He asks whether the state at this time dare impose and collect tax on these people to these causes and not to the frequency of elections. The effect, as far as it existed, ought to be chiefly ascribed. Now, when we talk about, you know, the consequences, because that's kind of what we were talking about, how can we have these checks? Well, there's no doubt in my mind that if all of a sudden you have to pay more and more, you're not going to be voting for the same people that keep taking. And as a matter of fact, you'd probably be supporting the people that say, we're going to give back to you. We're going to undo some of these things. And that doesn't mean that they'll actually do it. This is why. And to me, this is one of the things that's completely missing in the notes here, because they're not focused. And this actually becomes really apparent in the ratification debates, that when you're focused on those powers enumerated, then government cannot spend money on anything that is not enumerated. So when it comes down to the fact that they're spending money, they come to you and they tax you and say, hey, we need this money to pay this debt. Well, hold on here. How did you acquire debt for something you had no power to spend that money on? And this is the difficult conversation that needs to happen, because when we look at our national debt, this is the reality that government has been spending since the beginning of the progressive era. And actually, even before the progressive era, they have been spending money on things they had no authority to spend. And they were creating and recurring and maintaining a level of debt to do this. Had they only spent the money to maintain government based on those constitutional powers, then bottom line, we would not owe that money. And technically, and by the law, we do not owe that money. A public servant has defied the trust and violated the law in writing the check and basically making the withdrawal out of the treasury to pay for something unauthorized. In other words, when you've got actors frauding the people, then we have to step in and we actually have to start telling them, you have no right to serve anymore. All we've got to do, folks, is hold them accountable to the Constitution. Where do you have the authority to write that check to pay for those objects, to pay for that welfare, you know, to subsidize these wind farms, to subsidize these solar farms? All they're doing is supporting China in the manufacturing of this crap that they have no authority to mandate and put upon us. I want to be clear. What's going on with your public utilities in going down these paths of, you know, deploying these wind farms and you know, dismantling hydroelectric power to basically make America vulnerable is not only just kind of comical, it is criminal. Because the deaths and what's going to happen because they have given us an unstable, non-sustainable system and dismantled one that actually was sustainable, they should be held fully accountable. I can't emphasize this enough. So as we kind of go through, this was kind of the very first in a long series of many of speaking about property. And so the next one that we're actually going to bring up is July 4th. I believe it's on July 4th. No, it's July 2nd, the anniversary of the Declaration. And I think this is a long, this is kind of a long exchange, so we're not even going to get into this. It starts off with, nope, it's just Mr. Pinckney. It's just a long dissertation by Mr. Pinckney. Oh, not Mr. Pinckney. This is Governor Morris of Pennsylvania. Now, so when we come back tomorrow, actually tomorrow's Feedback Friday. Now, just a disclosure, I was asked if I could talk about the injustice that's happening and how the Supreme Court is literally, you know, raining tyranny upon the citizens and a lot of other things that they're doing. And so I'll dive into this. And what I want to do is when I talk about the Supreme Court, I think we really need to look at why counties matter most. Because right there, folks, I give you the academic argument that what the Supreme Court is doing, what our federal courts and what your state courts are doing are not within their powers. This is not just babble by GR. This is what the framers said. This is what John Marshall said in the Virginia ratification debates. And how they defined and denned or contained and limited the federal courts to being able to actually engage in any type of topic not under their jurisdiction. So we'll dive into this. I'm hoping that I hear from the gentleman that, you know, reached out to me. I'm going to move forward. So we'll find out tomorrow if we have the conversation over the phone. Or whether I just do a monologue, because I think the conversations are better. I think you get better served, especially the person with the question. They know when their answers, or when they're getting the real answers, or if they need more detail to understand better. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.